greetings and salutations to everybody across the land. This is the Judo Chop Suey Podcast, and I'm your host, Judo Dave Roman, coming back at you from the middle of nowhere in the Florida Panhandle with another episode for all you wonderful listeners. I appreciate you stepping into this audio dojo of mine, whether you're listening from Miami or New York City, or you're in the flyover states going all the way out to Rancho Cucamonga. I've always wanted to say that, Rancho Cucamonga. Let's not forget my international audience, who I appreciate so much, especially since you all have to tolerate this loudmouth U.S. American. On this episode of the Judo Chop Suey Podcast, I'm going to talk about the differences of being a coach versus being a sensei. I've got another Judo Fanatics review that I think you all find interesting. I've also got some judo-related news that I want to cover, especially heading into the Tbilisi Grand Slam as of this recording. And I'm probably going to have an after party as well. So I'd like to say before I kick off with the show, I really appreciate the support and the downloads and everything like that. And I don't keep track of downloads. I just know that they're happening. And I've received a lot of positive responses in the email. If you want to reach out to me about anything that I talk about today, you can reach out to me at judochopsuishow@gmail.com. I have resolved in this season two of the Judo Chop Suey Podcast that I'm going to keep things more positive and more constructive versus just kind of flying off the handle like I have in years past, which I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm really just not that kind of guy. And overall, I'm just really excited to be back doing this podcast kind of with a renewed mindset and covering subjects in a very different and very honest and very sincere way. Now, I want to be clear with all of you. I'm still working out the challenges of getting back into podcasting. I may ramble a little bit here and there. I'm still trying to get my groove on. I'm kind of like an experienced Shodan or Dan rank holder that haven't been doing judo for like 5 years and they step onto the mat. The skills are still there, but they're a little bit rusty, you know? It's kind of the same way with me and podcasting. I'm still a little bit rusty, but I'm going to catch my groove probably in another episode or two, and I'll be good to go. So if I ramble, if I kind of lose my train of thought, just be patient with me. I'm going to get there. I promise. I'm going to be better than ever. Just give me a little bit of time and trust the process here. So on the last episode of this podcast, I briefly talked about some of the changes that the USJA made. I know, Keith, stay with me. I'm snapping my fingers trying to keep you awake. Stay with me, people who are in international audiences. I'm going to loop this back to all of you, but please be a little bit patient as I try and run through some of the changes that the USJA, the United States Judo Association, has made pertaining to rank. Now, the biggest thing that is really different compared to most other judo organizations around the world is that promotion points are eliminated. So now promotions all the way up through Sandan is going to be a single required, like minimum time and grade type of deal. And apparently they have a calculation on how that's to be determined. So, you could have a guy that's been a name whatever rank for 10 years, but they only show up once a week versus a person that shows up 5 days a week over that period of time. There is considerations made for people who show up more. There's some kind of a calculation involved, but the long and short of it is that it's a minimum time and grade requirement for all ranks up to Sandan. And like most other judo organizations, you have to pass a test required of certain techniques. I guess there is some, how would I put it? Like maybe some flexibility in terms of what techniques you can demonstrate. I'm not quite sure about that. And you have to be able to demonstrate nage no kata for Shodan, but that starts demonstrating nage no kata, if I'm not mistaken, at Sankyu. So what I mean by that is that a Sankyu, for Sankyu, has to be able to pass the first set of nage no kata. For Nikyu, you have to pass the second and third sets. And for Ikkyu, you got to pass the fourth and fifth sets. So in a general sense, I think these are good changes overall to try and produce black belts and future sensei. Now, here's the important parts, or one of the important parts that I really wanted to discuss about this with a minimum time and grade requirement. Per their website, if somebody were to spend the bare minimum at each rank, and that's another thing. Judo clubs can now promote up to Sandan at the discretion of the head sensei. So, for example, if you're a fourth degree, you can test and promote your own students up to Sandan, up to third, without going through any sort of promotion board. My feeling on that, I think that's good for Shodan. I think a head sensei should be able to promote up to Shodan without answering to anybody. About Nidan and Sandan, I don't really have a strong opinion either way. I can see both sides of it. And I'm trying to not let my own personal experiences and biases cloud my judgment. I think I lean more toward the side that I think it's a good thing a club sensei can promote up to Sandan, provided they follow all the rules and stuff. It's just, to me, Shodan is like an advanced student rank. And then when you get to Nidan and Sandan, I think those ranks should have a little more scrutiny than what's outside of than what's within a club. I'm okay with it. Like I'm good with it. I'm sure a Yondan and higher can easily determine who's deserving of a Nidan and a Sandan. I think ranks up the. I think that's okay. I know I'm going back and forth here. So where was I going with that? Okay, so at the minimum time and grade requirements, a club could produce a Shodan, theoretically, in 29 months. Now, in my opinion, that'll never happen with the Nage no Kata requirements. So I don't think anybody out there in the judo world should be concerned, you know, if, you know, of the kind of black belts the USJA is producing. I don't think that's a concern there. And I still think, despite these requirements, it's going to take still about 5 years or so on average for an adult. Now, I'm talking strictly adults here. For an adult to go from white belt to Shodan, provided they're training 3 times a week or so. You know, if you go 3 times a week for an hour and a half each class, that's going to be about a little bit under 1,200 hours over the course of those 5 years. And to me, anywhere between 1,000 and 1,600 hours, it's what's required. Mat hours, it's what's required for Shodan, which is why I'm not like a big fan of minimum time and grade, because you really need a calculation to determine, well, you know, how many hours on the mat do you actually have under your belt? Now, as I'm talking about this, something did just dawn on me while I'm just chattering away here, is that if a club can promote up to Nidan and Sandan, my concern here is that these kind of requirements can keep potential coaches stuck in a club out of some sense of loyalty to their sensei, or just some sense of wanting to pursue rank in judo, which isn't a bad thing. I think it's only a bad thing if your entire focus in doing judo is to just acquire rank. And I don't know if the USJA is eliminating their certified rank examiner program with this. I've got no idea. So my concern here again is that, okay, great. So if a club promotes to somebody to Shodan and it takes 5 years to do that, and those people want to be promoted to Nidan and Sandan, or at the very least Nidan, it keeps coaches within a club, which is great for the club owner. But how is that good for trying to expand judo in your local community and branching out from there? So while I think these changes are good, I don't, they're good for producing future sensei, right? I think that's great. But I think in the United States, we have a problem with coaching. We don't have enough coaches. And I want to make a distinction between a sensei and a coach here so that nobody's confused, because a sensei can be a coach, but a coach isn't necessarily a sensei. Like for myself, I consider myself a judo coach. I don't consider myself a judo sensei. I would never, as a matter of fact, I don't have the kids at my club call me sensei. I refuse for anybody to call me sensei, because to me, a real sensei is somebody that's a yandan or higher. I that might rub some people the wrong way. If you got a club where you have your kids call you sensei out of some sense of wanting to instill a title and a sense of respect, I'm okay with that. I'm not really being critical on that issue. I'm just saying, for me personally, I don't want to be called a sensei, because I, in my opinion, a sensei is somebody who's a fourth degree or higher. To further clarify, just to make it really simple, I expect a sensei to be knowledgeable in everything. A sensei should know everything about judo, history, techniques. They should be able to demonstrate every, by fourth, in my opinion, I know, again, this is just my opinion, I think by fourth degree, you should be able to demonstrate every single technique in Kodokan judo. And you should have a certain amount of knowledge in kata. I think that is the bare minimum. I don't think that's too wild of a standard to hold for somebody that is a yandan or higher. Now, a coach, on the other hand, can be somebody that's proficient in judo, that can share their knowledge and doesn't have to know everything. They're just somebody like myself. That's why I call myself a coach. That's why the kids at the club, you know, call me Coach Dave, and some of the adults too. I still feel a little uncomfortable with the coach, but at least with the kids, there's a sense of title, so they call me coach. It does sound weird when a kid comes up to me and say, "Hey, Dave," you know, that's like, "Hey, how are you?" Yeah, that kind of thing. It's a little odd, but what ends up happening if a kid does that, usually some of the other kids will say it's Coach Dave. They'll kind of stand up for me, but I never, you know, I never want to make a kid feel awkward or embarrassed over something so irrelevant as titles, you know? Anyway, where was I going? So yeah, so something that had just dawned on me really a couple of weeks ago was when thinking about requirements, promotion requirements that just about every single judo organization has across the world. Judo organizations have a path to ranking up that is great for producing sensei. But we do not have, really, organizations don't really have clear paths to producing coaches. And I think that is a problem. It takes judo as a whole way too long to produce a coach. And it shouldn't be that way. Like I said earlier, it takes about 5 years on average to produce a shodan, somebody that's a recreational person. I'm not talking about the competitors that started as kids and, you know, 10 years later, they earned their shodan through competitions and stuff. I'm strictly talking about adults here. It takes, on average, guy goes 3-4 times a week, about 5 years or so. Takes on average about 4 years to maybe produce an EQ, in my opinion, somewhere between 3 and 4 years. Now, I don't know what the minimum requirements for being a coach is in the United States. Sometimes I hear it's EQ with some org. Sometimes I hear it's Shodan. So let's just go with Shodan is the minimum requirement to be a coach in the United States for judo. So I did some maths here, right? I can use the maths plural, right? That's like more of an English thing, I guess. I said maths. I meant math. I did the math, maths, whatever. All right. There are, according to the USJA, 234 active clubs that belong to the USJA. Now, let's imagine for a moment that all of these clubs just wipe the slate clean. They're just opening their doors. They're starting their clubs and whatever the case may be. All the students are white belts, right? Let's just say that these clubs, on average, run classes 3 times a week for an hour and a half, right? So we have already established, or I've already established earlier, that it takes about 1,200 hours, give or take, to produce a Shodan, which at 3 times a week is about 5 years. Now, going with this, let's assume that each club produces 1 to 2 black belts every 5 years. So with that in mind, with going with the calculation, I'm going to say each judo club that belongs to the USJA, all 234, produce an average of 1.5 black belts every 5 years. You multiply that number by 234, by 234 clubs, that's 70 shodan produced every 5 years. That's 70. That's 70 potential coaches. Some of them might go into refereeing. Some of them may not want to have to do anything to do with coaching. But let's just say, let's just assume for a moment that 70, that all of the clubs that belong to the USJA produce 70 shodan. It would take the USJA 14 years to produce 1,000 shodan. Now you tell me. You can write to me at judochopsuishow@gmail.com. You tell me, is that enough to grow judo in the United States? Assuming those 1,000 shodan produced over 14 years all want to be coaches, is that enough? I simply don't think so. I don't think that is anywhere near enough to potentially keep this sport and keep this budo, this martial art, whatever you want to call judo, whatever judo is for you. That is not enough to keep this thing going in this country. Not by nowhere near is that enough. And those coaches, those potential 1,000 coaches developed over 14 years or 70 produced every year, those people are going to likely stick in their own clubs. They're not going to leave the club to start their own judo program. So really, yeah, I don't really see how you're growing anything here. Yeah, sure, you're producing more of your own club shodans, but that's not really getting those people coaching. They're just shodans. Now, let's even go with the argument that that these organizations allow for EQ to be coaches. Well, it still takes about 4 years to produce an EQ in most places, right? So it's going to take you 4 years to produce a coach? While USA Wrestling has a certification program that can produce a certified USA Wrestling coach in 4 hours. So let's see, USA Wrestling can produce a kids coach in 4 hours, yet it takes 4 years for judo to produce an EQ at minimum, even if they are allowed to coach. They need to do it under the quote-unquote supervision of the sensei. That's not good enough. And I guess the thing that frustrates me a little bit about this whole thing is there are many people in judo that do not think wrestling is a technically deep sport. And it is. Everybody, you know, people that now you folks out there that actually wrestled, you know. You all know that it's a very deep technical sport that goes way beyond just shooting for singles and doubles. As a grappling sport, it is a very sophisticated, very technical sport. I cannot stress that enough because, again, so many people out there think the opposite. And my point here is that judo is not so special that it needs to spend so much time to produce a low-level coach. My opinion, and I know this is controversial, as controversial as I get for judo. I mean, come on, this is a hideous judo podcast. But what I'm about to say is a little controversial. But I think as a whole, not just the United States, in countries where judo is truly struggling and losing ground for the kids' attention spans and stuff, we need to lower the requirements for coaching. We need to significantly lower the requirements for coaching. And what I mean by that is perhaps having some kind of a certification system where, similar to USA Wrestling, where, for example, I'm not saying 4 hours, But let's say if you got a motivated person that really wants to teach kids, that loves judo, wants to teach kids judo. Maybe their rank isn't quite up there. But certify certain people so that they can teach certain techniques to younger kids or even beginner adults for that matter. Have a formalized certification that says, okay, you are bronze level coach. You can only teach Osotogari, Ouchigari, Ippon Seinagi, Keisekatami, and Ukemi. That is all you can teach. But if you can get people who are motivated to share what little judo they know, put them in other places, other schools, other, say, what I'm doing in a Brazilian jiu-jitsu school. Because let me tell you, and I alluded to this last week, and I'm not bashing on jiu-jitsu. It's just the way that it is. Brazilian jiu-jitsu is bereft of solid jacketed wrestling fundamentals. That is, unless you have a guy like me teaching a judo club or teaching at a jiu-jitsu club or a sambo guy or I don't know, whatever forms of jacketed grappling that are out there. There's several. And heck, let's just keep Brazilian jiu-jitsu out of this. Even starting up a local program in your local community, you don't have to be a black belt with years and years of experience to teach a kid Osotogari, to teach Ukemi, to teach Keisekatami. You don't need to be a black belt for that. That's ridiculous. I'm sorry, that's ridiculous to me. Because this just is not working to produce coaches. It's great to produce sensei. I think it's fantastic to keep the standards high. But to produce a coach to teach some kids or adults some Ukemi so that they make sure that they don't bang their head when they fall, you don't need to be a brown belt or a black belt for that. Why does a judo coach teaching such a few techniques like that need to also know nage no kata? I don't think that should be a requirement for coaching. It should be if you want to be a sensei, not necessarily for a coach. And those people who are, you know, let's say, I'm just using the example of a bronze tier coach that can only teach a couple of ranks. Those people would be affiliated with an actual dojo that could do promotions, that can kind of keep an eye on what's being taught without forcing everybody to come to your club. So coming full circle here, I guess, how does this tie into my international listeners? And there's many of you out there, or at least, well, there was when I was doing this regularly, but now I think you're all gone, most of you. But anyway, where is it going? Yeah. You people who are in Germany, the UK, Russia, Japan, Korea, and everywhere else in between, you all had better recognize that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a fast and growing sport. Consider this a warning. Now, again, I love Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I don't have an issue with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu's growth at all. But the United States, what has happened to judo in this country should serve as a warning because, you know, jiu-jitsu didn't just grow overnight to become the most popular grappling sport in this country. And I don't think there's any debate about that. I don't think that's crazy for me to say anymore. 5-10 years ago, that would have been absurd for me to say. I would have just said, oh, it's got to be wrestling, right? Maybe not. Not if you include every single adult that is doing jiu-jitsu and every single kid. There's no, I think jiu-jitsu eclipses wrestling. The last number I heard from USA Wrestling with all kids doing it scholastically, and that's not including the NCAA, is about, let's see, I think the number was after post-pandemic, 250,000. And I don't have the NCAA numbers for all three divisions, but wow, what would be, I mean, I think I would be overshooting it if I said the college athletes make up another 100,000. So let's just say there's 350 to 400,000 wrestlers in the United States across all levels. Well, that is easily eclipsed by the amount of people doing jiu-jitsu in this country, which conservative numbers is over a million. That is conservative. It's probably many more than that, many more millions, but conservatively, at least a million. No question about it. So you people in Europe, you people in Asia, You all better not be standing there on the sidelines with your hands grabbing your own lapels like Sensei John Kreese in The Karate Kid, just with an air of confidence that you're untouchable, because you're not. It is my understanding that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is blowing up in Japan and South Korea, two countries that were known for its strength in judo. Now, I'm not saying that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is more popular in those countries, but it's growing. And if people in decision-making positions are just standing there just saying, hey, we're an Olympic sport, we're untouchable. That's what people thought in the United States 35 years ago, 30 years ago. And how did Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu grow? Well, of course, the UFC helped, right? We all know that. UFC won, you know, which again, I always make the case that Royce Gracie didn't do anything in UFC 1 apart from the striking that is not taught in any judo club in the world. I mean, all he did was judo. I mean, there's nothing that he did that was really unique to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, or back then Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. So coming full circle again, I think that's two or three circles by now. How did Jiu-Jitsu grow? They allowed blue belts to open their own clubs. They allowed purple belts to open their own clubs. And nobody stopped them. Nobody was there shaking a finger in their face saying, no, you can't do that. You got to be part of this. You got to be part of that. You got to pay your dues here. Nothing stopped those people from opening clubs. I mean, when they found a purple belt or a brown belt or a black belt to promote to blue belt, a lot of those people went off and built their own school. I know a guy. This would have been, let's see, early to mid 2000s. He was a blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he opened his own Jiu-Jitsu school that doubled as an after-school care business. So basically, for after-school, your kids would get out of school around 2:30. He would pick them up in his large van, bring them to his place. He would help the kids with homework, and he would help have games and activities for the kids. But at 4 o'clock. Between 4 and 5 o'clock, he would be teaching those kids jiu-jitsu as a blue belt. And then from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock, because back then in Tampa Bay, it would take you an hour to drive 5 miles. And I'm sure it's worse now. But then from 5 to 6, he would just have regular games and stuff. But all those kids did jiu-jitsu. That was part of the program. That was part of the deal. And then afterwards, he would have an adult class. And that was a very successful business for him. He ended up growing and growing and growing, and the spaces that he had to rent out got bigger and bigger and bigger. And which is really crazy to me. He actually quit it all. He was a 4-stripe brown belt and he quit jiu-jitsu. Can you believe that? I can't believe that. I think his wife, his new wife at the time, had compelled them to quit so that they can focus on their other business. So, yeah, 4-stripe brown belt quitting Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Yeah, he was probably 3 or 4 months away from black belt, but he quit. But anyway, that's not my point. The point is that Jiu-Jitsu grew because of enthusiastic people that didn't have black belt skills, but they wanted to share what they knew. And they had no shame making money with that. Another person, going back to episode 40 of this podcast, maybe did this interview 4 years ago, Cody Stray. He had a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club that he was running as a purple belt. And now he's got to be a double black belt by now. I know for sure he earned a Shodan in judo. I'm not quite sure about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but I'm almost sure that he did. I follow him on Instagram, but again, I uninstalled Instagram. So, you know, Cody, if you happen to be listening to this, I hope all's well with you. I hope everything's going great. I hope training's good. I appreciate that interview, even though you saying that again years later. But still, again, purple belt opened up his club, sharing what he knew. He had students. Judo needs to go down this road. They really do, because that's the only way you're going to even remotely stay relevant, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. I'm telling you all people in decision-making positions in other countries, You'd better have plan B, because if your plan A fails, you're going to be, your judo is going to be just as obscure a sport in your country as it has become in the United States. Now, I know I'm belaboring this point a little bit, but I still have two more things that I want to say. I recall having a conversation with Tabrin Lee, who has been a three-time guest on this podcast. Tabrin, if you're listening, hope all is well. We were talking about coaching. Gosh, this must have been about 2 years ago or so. And he was telling me about either a wrestling coach he knows or was his wrestling coach in high school was somebody that produced state champions. And the guy didn't have a single hour of mat experience in wrestling in his life. And Tabrin's point at the time to me was coaching is really all about getting people to do what you want them to do. And quite frankly, I'm seeing that in my own jiu-jitsu club. My head instructor, Jordan, he blew out his knee a couple of weeks ago, and he cannot do anything remotely that resembles jiu-jitsu at all. His leg is in a brace. It's constantly straight out. He's in a wheelchair. He has been in a wheelchair. Now he's bumping around on crutches a bit, but he was in a wheelchair for at least 2 weeks. So what has he been doing? He's been coaching on the sidelines, using people like myself and other students as the demonstrators, doing and demonstrating the things that he's not physically able to demonstrate. And we're still having effective classes. And why is that? Because as a coach, he's getting his students to do what he wants them to do. So yeah, that's why, again, in my opinion, I don't think it would be such a terrible thing to have lower level ranked people, lower ranked people who act as lower tier coaches. I don't think that would be a terrible thing, because that's what we need here. We need more coaches. All right. So I want to transition to the next part of this podcast, next section, if you want to call it. I said in my last episode that I wanted to start doing some reviews of Judo Fanatics videos, things that I find very helpful for myself, for my own personal development, either as a person just trying to improve their own judo or as a coach. Well, for this one, it's about coaching. And I want to give a review of a video I purchased, maybe about a month and a half ago. It's called Kids Judo Blueprint by Riley McIlwain. Now, I'm not doing this review because I know Riley's a listener. I know he's a listener. I know he's listened. I'm not sure if he realizes I'm back. It doesn't matter. I mean, hopefully he does. But either way, I'm not doing this because I know he's a listener. I'm doing this because I think it's a great video. So, and not only is this a good video for coaches teaching kids, I'll be quite frank with you. I think this is a good video for coaches teaching judo beginners. And I think for myself, it's been somewhat of a challenge, or it has been a challenge. I think I've gotten good at this over the past year and a half, almost 2 years, but it was a challenge for me to try and convey the things that come, that have always come relatively easy for me, to people, kids or adults, where judo does not come relatively easy. And I mean that even as a white belt in judo, judo was relatively easy for me compared to the average person, because I came into judo with a high degree of athleticism, balance, coordination, agility. So I was already pretty fit when I started, but a lot of people are not that way. So to try and get kids and adults to do certain things that just come second nature to people who are Don rank is not easy. If I'm not mistaken, I believe Riley is a Sandan under Jimmy Pedro, and he runs the kids' classes at Pedro's Judo Center. If I'm not mistaken, I don't know if that's changed over the past year. I know he was associated with Jimmy Pedro for a very long time, competed at his club, that kind of thing. So right away, I started using some of the things that he covered on this video, in particular with the Yoko Ukemi, the side Ukemi, Zenpo Kaiten Ukemi, the forward rolling. He has this great idea. I can't believe I didn't think of this myself. Doing a kickstand principle for the side break fall. It's for the kids. It's just fantastic. I even started having the adults, some of the adults that are new, that still can't quite get the Yoko Ukemi. I just thought, I don't know how I didn't even think of that, but it was so much better than what I was already doing with the kids. Normally with the kids, what I have them do is squat down and stick a leg out. And I'd also have them stick their hand out. But a lot of times they were misbalanced. They just fall over and stuff. But the kickstand principle was just fantastic. Now, I can't really go into that much detail via this medium of theater of the mind. So you'd have to order the video to see what I'm talking about. Now, speaking of ordering the video, I got this on a daily deal, and then I use like a 48% off coupon. So I think I literally only paid, I think, $11 for the video. It's on sale for a lot more than that right now. I think it normally goes for about, I think $77 is the full price. But as you guys know, if you go to Judo Fanatics or BJJ Fanatics on any regular basis, a lot of these videos rotate in and out in terms of deals. And I'm sure it'll one day be the daily deal. Currently right now another video, one of the Travis Stevens ones, the Ultimate Takedown series, which I reviewed, I think, in the very last episode of season one of the Judo Chop Suey podcast. Certainly one of the episodes in the 90s. So going back to the Kids Judo Blueprint, fantastic stuff. The forward break fall, that's been another one that I've had challenges with the kids.
Yes.
And there were some minor things that Riley showed in the video that has already paid off big dividends for me in trying to get the kids to do forward breakfalls. I normally have them start from the knees, but there's this little trick that he kind of covers in lifting one knee up and putting the other knee down. I'm like, my goodness, that's so brilliant. Why didn't I even think of that? I mean, it's really simple stuff that he gets across that I think is just really helpful. And the Ukemi has been a challenge for me in teaching new kids. So yeah, it's been a tremendous help already. Now, thankfully for me, he covers how to teach Ukemi for younger kids, like say 4 and 5 year olds. I normally don't accept kids into the judo class unless they are at least 5 and they've got some sort of siblings or something that can help them. Because look, for me, it's my judo class, and it's only me. And there's a lot of times that my max for kids is 12. 12 is the most amount of kids that I can handle by myself without help. Anything more than 12, then it gets really tricky for me because I don't feel like things are safe. And then, you know, when you have kids that are 5 years old and you've got a class of kids that are mostly 9 and 12, it can be very difficult to pair kids up. So normally, when it comes to really young kids, they got to have somebody else that's their age, or they've got to be able to work with their siblings. Now, I got a girl that just turned 6. She's been coming to my judo class for, gosh, almost a year or so. She's like the sweetest little thing ever. And a mat monster at already, she's 6. She's a mat monster. She's really fantastic. I'm not just saying that because I'm biased. I mean, the kid's a killer out there. But I allowed her to be in the judo class because she has an older brother and sister that were also part of the judo class as well. So they were able to bring her along, and she does great. But a lot of times I've had kids in the past that don't listen very well, and it can be very difficult. And for me, with the limited schedule that I have, I can really only dedicate teaching judo once a week at my Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club, Zikaro Academy. So I'm not able to have a more advanced kids class versus a more beginners class. The club as a whole has this really neat program called the Little Ninjas, which is for kids like between the ages of 2 and 5. And that's a lot of fun. They do a lot of developmental games and things like that. I can never make it there because it runs too early for me. I'm usually taking care of my rabbit and my pets and stuff like that. Yeah, I got a rabbit. I don't know if you guys know that. I got a Holland Lop rabbit, the best pet ever, honestly. But anyway, where was I? Yeah, forward breakfall. So really great tips to teach forward breakfalls that I've never really seen before. I've seen he goes over using the medicine ball for Ukemi, and I've never that's another one. I've heard of people using a medicine ball for Ukemi, but Riley really breaks down how to use a medicine ball in, for kids teaching Ukemi. And I think he does a great job with that. So in this video series, there's at least 2.5 hours worth of material, and it's broken up into four sections. The first section is largely Ukemi and creating Kazushi and the basics of Tachiwaza and footwork and partner drills. Part two goes into actually teaching certain techniques like Marote Seyanagi, Ippon Seyanagi, Koichigari. Yes. Now that's all from section two of the blueprint. And what I really like about it is that he goes into breaking down and troubleshooting some of the common things that he sees with the kids. Now, thankfully, a lot of what I've watched in this video series, I tend to be doing a lot of those things. So I suppose learning through trial and error and really learning how to teach, I've managed to do some of the same type of things. The little tidbits of information that he says, like, turning the head and sitting on your butt and that kind of thing, I think those are really valuable kind of talking points. And I use it for both kids and adults. It's just with the adults, I can explain things with a little more detail that I feel like with the kids, I would end up losing them. Now, in section three, he goes over Ogoshi, the basics of Ouchigari. He's got some more drills and a half Nelson series, knee drills type things. And I would say from about the halfway point of section three, going all the way into section four is specific to Niwaza. Now, I gotta be honest with you, since I teach judo at a Brazilian jiu-jitsu club, I don't teach much judo Niwaza. I do cover it. I cover the basics because I want the kids to know what these positions are, knowing the Japanese terminology and things like that. But quite frankly, I don't really want to mess with their ground game very much, other than emphasizing the importance of top position and pinning, osaikomi techniques. Because let me tell you, and this is going to rankle a lot of people that are listening, most of these kids that are in my class, they have better Niwaza skill than most judo shodan that I've come across in terms of just people that have only done judo and not done any cross training whatsoever. They're better. They just are. Hate to say it. It's not because judo Niwaza is bad. That's not what I'm saying at all. It's just since the sport of jiu-jitsu just has spent so much time on the ground for obvious reasons. That's the whole point of the sport. Those kids are really significantly ahead of people who are, who've got 5, 6 years in judo. They just are. I mean, it's hate to say it. It's just, technically speaking and their fundamentals and everything. So I don't really mess with that too much in terms of Niwaza. I do show them a couple of turtle turnovers because that's not something one thing I want to say, and I'm probably going off on the tangents here. I got to say, because I've taught like kids jujitsu. And I've taught kids judo, but I'm really a higher level blue belt. Like I said before, I should be getting my purple soon at some point this year. But I'm a higher level blue belt, so every once in a while I have to help the kids, with teaching or whatever. Brazilian jiu-jitsu is very, very complicated to teach kids compared to judo. Just my opinion. That has been my experience because I feel like Gosh, what were we working the past couple of weeks? For people who don't do jiu-jitsu, you're not going to know what this is. But the headquarters position in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, to do that correctly and to try and teach kids, there's like 5 or 6 different things you have to cover for them to successfully do that move and to pass somebody's guard into a passing position to a side control or some other type of osaikomi. Where with most judo techniques, I can break it down at a macro level to no more than three steps. Now, obviously, there's a lot of things going on when it comes to doing a basic throw like Ogoshi. There's a lot happening. You have to pull the sleeve properly. You have to have the proper hand placement and stuff. But I can basically take the grip, show them at a macro level the 2 or 3 steps that they need to do. A lot of times I try and teach the kids right from 2 steps because I I'm going to rankle some people. I think the subject of Kazushi is overrated when it comes to teaching beginners. So I don't really cover it that much. I just try and cover what it is that they need to do to actually execute the throw. Because, you know, a lot of these kids, they see me break the balance first and then, you know, that's 1 and then 2 is entry and then 3 is the execution of the throw. But a lot of times what I have found beginners make the mistake of is that they think you have to break the balance first when you're actually doing the throws for real. And I don't think that happens. Nobody breaks the balance first and then enters in. That doesn't happen. Watch any high level judo tournament. They're not breaking the person's balance first. So when I teach kids and adults for that matter, I do show them the 1-2-3 version, but very quickly I move away from there. And I never talk about Kazushi because I just think it goes over people's heads. And when they start hearing about it, then they're worrying about things like, oh, did I have enough Kazushi? It's like, it's silly. And to be honest, like for myself, I don't think I started developing an actual truly inherent understanding of Kazushi until about I was 10 years in, honestly. I mean, it's crazy that that sounds. Yeah, obviously I know, you know, in a general sense, Kazushi means off balancing or breaking the posture or destroying balance. I always understood that intellectually, but really understanding the Dabana and the Kazushi, that took a while for me. And and I was already throwing people for years before I was like, oh, okay, now I kind of really get it. Like I really, you know, there was a boy, I say this all the time. There was a time years ago, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing some really good judo, really before the pandemic. Nowadays, not so much, but I mean, I'm good, but like my timing was just superb. There was just, gosh, 5 years ago, I was doing such good judo, and now, you know, not so much, really because I don't have the training partners like I used to have. Not for judo anyway. Where was I going with all that? Oh, yeah. Ooh, that was a tangent. What I was saying is that I find between judo and jiu-jitsu, a lot of kids tend to pick up judo easier. As a matter of fact, I've had a couple of kids tell me, wow, this is just so much easier to learn than jiu-jitsu. And you know, well, they've told me that privately, but now I've made that public. But I'm not naming names, Jordan. So anyway, if you find yourself in a position where you need to teach a kid's class and you're not really sure how to go about that, I highly suggest Kids Judo Blueprint by Riley McElwain. It's a fantastic video. He obviously knows what he's talking about. And given the kids' success at Pedro's Judo Center, clearly it's a teaching approach that works. So as of this recording, the Tbilisi Grand Slam will be coming up in a couple of days. Now, I'm hoping to have this episode released before that Grand Slam, but probably not. I thought about waiting until after the event is over to cover that event, but I think I'm just going to release this episode probably after the event, and maybe I'll cover some of the results of the Tbilisi Grand Slam in my next episode. But I will be watching the event live, or as much as possible. I'm looking forward to seeing Jack Unesca of the United States, who has qualified for the Olympics, which I didn't know that. I said in my last episode that I wasn't sure if he had qualified for the Olympics and that maybe he, if he didn't this year, he certainly would for 2028. But looking at the Olympic rankings for on the International Judo Federation website, it does show that he's qualified. That's to go along with Maria Laborde in the under 48 kilo division. She's ranked number 10. And Angelica Delgado, who's currently ranked number 22 in the under 52 kilo division. John Jane is, it appears that he's in on the continental quota, currently ranked 27th in the under 90 kilo division. So fantastic for all of them. I didn't realize, I guess I've been asleep at the wheel. I didn't realize that the Olympic qualifications have already been settled by the IJF. Now, as a reminder, just because you're qualified doesn't necessarily mean your nation will send you. I know that happened to a couple of people in other countries in the last Olympics where they were qualified. They did all that work to travel around the world. And I'm not talking to anybody from the United States. I think there was a lady out in Australia or New Zealand where she had qualified, but the country decided not to send her, which I think is a shame. So John Jane and Jack Nunesco will both be competing in Tbilisi. Teddy Riner is going to be competing in Tbilisi, and he may end up matching up with Andy Granada of Cuba, who won the World Championships in 2022. Now, as you all know, since Georgia is the host country, they get to stack their divisions. So they're going to have a very full roster of several competitors in many weight divisions. A notable name that will be missing from this event is Luka Mizoradze of Georgia because he got popped for a drug test. Suspended. Well, I don't know if I should call that breaking news or not, but yeah, there you have it. I guess this broke. So I got this story from The Spirit of Judo. It's a French publication. It's actually called Le Spirit du Judo. I think I got that pronunciation correct. It's a French online article that follows the sport of judo, very much like Judo Inside, just for French people. Now, according to the article, this news broke quite a while ago on a Russian Telegram channel. If you guys are familiar with the Telegram app, I'm talking about that Telegram. So I guess there's a Russian Telegram channel that specializes in judo. Apparently, the news broke back in February at some time that the Georgian world champion 2023 in the under 90 kilo division and world number one, he is the current world number one, was suspended for doping. The statement, this is according to the article, the statement remained unimplemented and unconfirmed in the following weeks. But at the end of last week, new reports were emerging. Luka Mizoradze was reportedly suspended until October 2024. So that means if he had a chance, I know he qualified for the Olympics, but if he had a chance to represent Georgia at the Olympics, that is no more. Now, according to the publication and continuing on, it says, in order to confirm or deny, the Spirit of Judo contacted the International Judo Federation, which in an email response says, quote unquote, does not deny the fact that the athlete is ineligible until October of 2024. A statement confirmed by the consultation of the website of the Georgian Anti-Doping Agency. I love the terminology. Why doesn't the IGF just come out and say, yeah, he's suspended, he broke the rules? Instead of something coy like, we cannot confirm or deny that said athlete is ineligible. I don't know. So continuing on to the article, the commission published a 15-page document on December 5th of 2023 concerning the suspension of Luka Mizoradze. What, do you need 15 pages to confirm that somebody popped on a drug test? I mean, what do you have to talk about? I suppose you got to cover protocols and what he got tested for and what he failed, but 15 pages? Really? All right. Continuing on. The Georgian agency's control took place on April 12, 2023. On the same day, the samples were sent to the laboratory accredited by the World Anti-Doping Agency in Cologne, Germany. It is found in sample A of Osterine, a non-steroidal anabolic, which promotes muscle mass gain, improved recovery, and weight loss. Now, I had to ask some people. I initially heard this story on Reddit, on the judo subreddit. I have no idea what Osterine is, and apparently there were some people laughing in the comments about it. I guess it's not like your typical anabolic steroid, like Stanozolol or something like that. I know nothing about steroids. I mean, not even next to nothing. I know nothing about steroids. I've never done them. I never have any intention of doing them. Apart from the few times I've been given them by a prescription to deal with respiratory issues. But somebody in the comments had kind of likened this to failing a drug test for creatine. I guess it's a really stupid way to fail a drug test. Now, what I do find interesting is that they had these drug results by the time Luca won his world championships back in May, because it wasn't until June 9th of 2023 when the labs notified the Georgian agency of its results. And continuing on with the article, which informed the judoka and the Georgian Federation a few days later. Now, thankfully, the IJF hasn't taken away Luca's gold medal, which I think, you know, some people would probably call for that. I know when steroids was a scandal in baseball, people wanted to put asterisks and keep people out of the Hall of Fame. They're still doing that, by the way, 20 years later after the fact. But thankfully, they're not doing that here. And even if they did, let's say they took away Luca's gold medal, well, he beat his countryman, Lasha Bekaruri of Georgia. So either way, Georgia wins. It's not like they lose anything in terms of their judo program. So let them keep the gold medal. I don't think there's any discussion of taking away a gold medal or putting an asterisk next to his name or anything like that. So yeah, I am looking forward to watching the Tbilisi Grand Slam. It's usually a fantastic event, and I would expect that this is going to be the same. Like I said before, I'm really interested in seeing Teddy Riner compete in this one, because this is one of the tournaments he's chosen to kind of prep himself for the games in Paris, which are, let's see, how many days is that away now? It's got to be about, I would say about 128 days as of this recording. Now, another tournament that I'm looking forward to watching, and I might be attending it live, is the New York Open Mixed Team International Judo Competition, which is at the New York Athletic Club. It's taking place on April 13th. I have been invited to be a guest there as a VIP, which is really nice. Now it's just a matter of me trying to secure a place to stay. I've asked my cousin. Hopefully he will... Hopefully he'll let me stay the weekend. I usually go there, but they have a lot of people like that visit New York City that they know that stay with them. Maybe they're getting sick of it, so I'm gonna bug my cousin one more time to see if I can stay with him. If not, I may have to book a hotel. I'm not sure yet. I've got a lot of traveling to do this year. I'm like 70% sure that I'm gonna go as of this recording. I need to follow up with my cousin. He lives down by the Kips Bay area of Manhattan. Lovely area. I love Manhattan. I love New York City. I love it more and more every time I go. And I would love to be a part of this and watch this live. If I can't watch it live, I will. I'll watch the live stream, because I think it's a fantastic event. I was supposed to go to this back in 2020, and then the world locked down because of the pandemic. Gosh, I can't believe that's been 4 years. My goodness. For the countries competing at this event, it looks like, well, obviously it's going to be the United States, of course, but it's also going to be Poland, Germany, Israel, Great Britain, and France, if I got that correct. I believe I got that correct. So, gosh, I really don't want to miss this. I got to bug my cousin so that I don't miss this. I would love to visit the New York Athletic Club. I've never been there in any capacity. I mean, I've walked past it plenty of times, just never actually been inside. So hopefully I can go. All right. So I think I'm going to start wrapping up this episode. There is one thing that I wanted to cover. I won't take too long covering this, but so I was listening to the Tatami Talk podcast, episode 100. And here's some background to this. Bringing the podcast back, I have thought about, I've considered about doing some, considered doing some kind of Patreon that if anybody wants to chip in a couple of bucks and support the podcast, you know, which eventually would go towards improving my equipment or whatever the case may be, that it would be lovely to do that. But then I was listening to Tatami Talk, their 100th episode. Congratulations, you guys. And they were talking about Patreon and the whole tax ramifications of Patreon and stuff. And I already have my own business. I'm having a mess of taxes. I goof things. I'm gonna owe big. It's gonna hurt. I'll survive. I'll be fine, but still, it's gonna suck. Anyway, I'm done with taxes. I'm done with Uncle Sham. And I am not going to look to pay taxes on something so small like a judo podcast and whatever little money that I would get from doing that. However, as you guys know, I love crypto. And what I'm going to do is that I am going to, in the show notes, I'm going to put some crypto addresses that go to a designated crypto wallet. You want to send me your meme coins? You want to send me a million Pepe coins? You go right ahead if you want to pay those Ethereum gas fees. Want to send me some sats, some Bitcoin sats? I would love it. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put some addresses. Send me some Monero. Send me your Floki coin. How about some Doge? Anything. I don't care how much you send. I would just love to have any sort of crypto, whatever, because I'm crypto crazy. Maybe one day that crypto will be worth a lot of money. Probably not $1 million. Maybe something a little bit less than that or a little more than that. So to put in perspective, if anybody were to send me a million Pepe coin, that's like $8.28 in U.S. coin. U.S. dollars. U.S. dollars. American dollars. Now, yes, I know I can't avoid Uncle Sam when it comes to crypto, or I should say Uncle Scam, but if I never convert that, I'll always have it, and maybe one day it'll be worth something, and then when I cash out, then I'll pay the taxes then, or maybe I'll roll over into something else. Who knows? I'll open up a Swiss bank account or something like that. I keep bringing up Pepe because that I've made like 10 times my initial investment. I've already pulled out my profits, or at least some of my profits, but I'm leaving the rest to run. Maybe that'll run. Maybe one day Pepe will be worth a dollar and I'll have like $33 million. Yeah, right. So no, I'll provide some wallet addresses. It will not be to my main wallet addresses because I don't want you crazy people, you know, start checking my wallet addresses on the blockchain and seeing how much money I got. Now that I keep to myself. So yeah, for me in this endeavor, if you guys send me crypto, it's not about how much you send. It's about it's the thought that counts. It really does. You want to send me 1,000 Floki coin to my address? That's the equivalent of 23 cents in dollars. You know, that reminds me, whatever happened to the IJF NFT type stuff? Did they ever do anything with that? I've got no idea if, oh my gosh, what a disaster that was. Wow. If any of you actually got those IJF NFTs, let me know. I'd love to ask you a few questions. Let's see. Oh, do you know what's going on right now? It's probably already, the tournament's already over, but I've been watching it the past couple of nights. The All Japan High School Judo Championships. Now, I don't know if, Kiyoshi of judofan.com is actually at that event, or he has students there. I got to send him an email and ask him, but it's been some really exciting judo. Wow, the tournament is being held at the Budokan, and It's a pretty full house. At least it looks it from. So they've been playing four mats, and I've been clicking around different mats and just looking at the arena as a whole. It seems like it's a full house. Certainly more people there for this than the Olympics. It's really interesting to watch because now, look, I'll be straight up with all of you. I don't really know the particulars of how the All Japan Judo Federation runs their tournaments, but it looks like a mix between using IJF rules and traditional officiating because they have corner judges. They have judges sitting at the corners of the tatami, and you have a main referee. So I don't think they're using any sort of replay. There's certainly no blue gi, that's for sure. And I'm not seeing any leg grabbing attempts, so I don't know if they go with traditional rule sets or whatever you want to call traditional at this point. But I got to tell you, from a judo point of view, it's been a really good week for me, starting with the All Japan Judo High School Championships and heading right into Tbilisi. So what I will do for you all, so I've been watching these events live through YouTube. I don't know if the channel that I'm watching these events will keep those videos up, but if they do, I'll link them in my show notes, and you all can take a look at that. It's really, really good judo, and these kids are just phenomenal. They would just destroy me within 10 seconds. They're amazing. All right, so I think I'm going to wrap this up here. If you made it this far, I really appreciate you. I know sometimes I'm still getting into the swing of things. I ramble on quite a bit. I go into tangents. I'm going to get better, trust me. At least it's not as bad as when I first started. But it's going to take me a while to get into the swing of things and podcasting and make sure that my train of thought doesn't go all over the place, because that tends to happen, just like it's happening right now. So anyway, so I'll wrap that up here. So with that, I hope you all have a great day. I hope you all have a great rest of the week. Train hard. Stay safe out there. And until next time, I'm out. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Oppa Gangnam Style. Hey, sexy lady. Op, 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 op. Oppa Gangnam Style. Hey. Sexy lady. The after party starts in 15 minutes. Welcome to my after party. So there's a couple of things that I want to talk about unrelated to judo. Things that you guys don't know about me, things that I've taken up over the past couple of years. I have become a novice amateur astronomer. I have been where I live in the country is so fantastic for stargazing. And I had this Orion telescope for years. It actually belongs to my sons. My father had bought it as a gift to my sons, like, gosh, 12, 13 years ago. And I've been, it's like a really old model type telescope. Like, you have to turn the things by hand and everything and adjust the telescope. It has an easy star finder at the top, but it's really hard to find deep space objects with this thing. I just was never really good at it. I probably should have taken the time to get better with this telescope before I bought my upgrade, but my upgrade is outstanding. It's a Skywatcher Virtuoso GTI. It's 150 millimeter aperture, which is 6 inches across. And it's just a much larger telescope than what I've been using. And wow, does it make it? It makes a huge difference. So just to give you an example, looking at the moon through my old telescope, like, I could see a lot of the craters and everything. The moon is really bright and obviously really big through a telescope. But through this new one, I can see like the mountains on the outline of the moon, like just how ragged it is. You know, when you look at the moon from just with your regular eyes, you just see the circle in there and you see some of the craters. But when you look at it through a telescope, especially the one that I have, you can see so much more detail. I just didn't realize how jagged the moon really is around. I mean, I knew, but I didn't really know until I saw this. And looking at Jupiter is so much clearer. And I was able to see Uranus for the very first time in my life. I had never seen Uranus. And the thing that's great about this telescope is that, unlike my old one, where you really had to know the degrees and angle and true north and everything and go from there. Once I calibrate the telescope, and you have to do it every time you set it up, but once I calibrate the telescope, I just use an app on my phone, I hit a few buttons, and boom, it points me right to these objects in space. I've never seen Uranus in my life, had no idea that it was bluish green. It just looks like, because it's so far away, it just looks like a little dot, but it's just amazing to see something that I've never seen before in deep space. Now, I've only tinkered this with this a couple of times. I bought it for myself as a birthday present for when I turned 49 early this year. Goodness gracious, am I really going to be 50 next year? I'm going to be 50 in 10 months. Yeah, unbelievable. Not the 50, right? My goodness. I still feel really good, though. I am right now, speaking of aging and everything, I know I mentioned in my last episode, if I wanted to compete in judo at 66 kilos, I could do it right now. I'm right at that weight. I'm right around 148 pounds. I would just have to not drink water for a day, and I would pretty much be right there, be at competition weight. I can't believe it that I've managed to drop this weight in the amount of time that I have. And I'm gonna stay here, one, because I look good, and two, I want to stay at this weight because it's a good weight. If I ever had an itch to do judo again, compete, I'm there. But I'm really more interested in doing jiu-jitsu for competing because I just want to compete before I get my purple belt. I just want that one. And I don't care if I win or lose. I just want to get that out of my system. And yeah, so I'm at the weight that I need to be at. I look good. I feel good. And I'm in great shape for almost 50. My cholesterol's in check. My heart rate, you know, my blood pressure is perfect. My cholesterol is finally down. Like just everything is just going really well for me. What else? Speaking of deep space and stuff, I gotta say, I'm sure maybe some of you are paying attention to this over the past year. Aliens. Now, the government has had these hearings on aliens, and you know what? I hate to say it, but I'm just gonna say it. If the government is talking about aliens, there's probably no aliens. Now, I do think, just my opinion, there are probably species of humanoids on this planet that we have just not discovered yet because they want nothing to do with us. I think that's a possibility. I think it's a possibility that they are technologically advanced. Because it's crazy as that sounds, scientists and we discover new species of animals, plants, insects every year. Every year we discover a new living organism that we never knew about. So why? Just because is it really that far-fetched to believe that there's a species of humanoids that are really Terrans that have been here this entire time? They want nothing to do with human beings? I don't think that's crazy at all. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. But either way, coming from aliens, coming from out of space in spaceships, I am now more and more likely not believing that because the government's talking about it. And going along those lines, in terms of shows and television shows, I got to tell you, the one show that I love watching that I never miss is The Y-Files on YouTube. I rag on a lot of shows on Netflix and stuff. YouTube has, in the past year, has become my go-to for entertainment for the most part. There is such good quality content on there that I don't pay for YouTube Plus or Live or whatever. The NFL on YouTube, my God, what a ripoff that is. And we know once the network deals are up, the NFL is going to be going towards streaming. Hopefully it's an a la carte service so that I only have to pay to watch the Bucks. But I think that's where we're going with streaming. I can pay. I wouldn't mind paying $100, let's say, for you know, to watch the Bucks home and road games from where I live. I would do that for a season, but the NFL on YouTube, I'm not paying what, $500. I'm not paying that to have access to games that I don't really care about. I don't want to see Washington and Arizona. I couldn't care less about that. I'm not paying money to see those teams. But there is so much quality content on YouTube, past and present, and new things coming out every week. There's just such good stuff. Like, I listened to a lot of Art Bell radio programs from years ago, and he's been dead for years. And but yet, there's a lot of people that post some of his stuff up there, not only from coast to coast, but Midnight in the Desert. There's some really good stuff out there. So yeah, the Y-Files has been fantastic. If you've never watched it, I would suggest that if you... Probably the past year and a half worth of material has been the best stuff. His earlier stuff is good, but the production quality wasn't nearly as good as it has been. But that's a really, really good show. I'm currently watching on Netflix, and I'm got one more episode to go, but I'm watching a crazy conspiracy show called The Octopus. I can't believe this. After watching this show, if you watch this show, if you don't believe that there's a deep state, you're going to believe that there's a deep state after watching this. Or by deep state, I'm talking about people who really run things in this country and around the world. And it's not the president and it's not Congress. It's the people that are accountable to nobody, and they have their hands into things that we have no say over. And they are unelected. There are plenty of people in our levels of governments that fall into that criteria that are really running things. And again, I know it sounds like crazy conspiracy Dave here, but I'm serious. I mean, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to acknowledge that there are unelected people making decisions that they probably shouldn't be making that are impacting every single one of us. And, you know, whatever you want to call that, I think a deep state is a catch-all term, but there are people that fall into that criteria. And this show on Netflix, The Octopus, really covers that. It's kind of scary to think that there are just people in this world that live that life, and they're unaccountable. Let's see, what else? On Hulu, I've been catching up on this show called The Goldbergs. That's a fantastic show. It's very, very funny. And for me, of course, I'm still waiting on the next season of Yellowstone. Come on, Taylor Sheridan. Look, where are your other good shows? I mean, 1923 was fantastic. Every series that guy has done has been gold. It is amazing television. And I'm hooked. I'm waiting for the next one. There was, what, 1882 or 1887 or 6? I can't remember. Fantastic show. Then they did 1923. Fantastic show. Apparently, there's a show coming out called The Four Sixers or something. It's about the cattle ranch in Texas. Can't wait for that. But I'm still waiting for Kevin Costner to get off his ass and do Yellowstone season 6 and finish it up, because we need to have closure with the Dutton family. I mean, come on. It's been way, way too long. All right. So, all right. That's it for me. I'm out.